the window, this must be important, because if it isn't, I'm going to throw you straight back out through it. Dandelion clambered off the sill, knocking down the rest of the onions. He sat down, pulling the high-backed wooden chair closer with his foot. The Witcher gathered Sharni's clothes and his own from the floor. He looked abashed and dressed in silence. The medical student, hiding behind him, was struggling with her shirt. The poet watched her insolently, searching in his mind for similes and rhymes for the golden colour of her skin in the light of the oil lamp and the curves of her small breasts. "What's this about, Dandelion?" The Witcher fastened the buckles on his boots. "Go on." "Pack your bags," he replied dryly. "Your departure is imminent."
"How imminent?"
"Exceptionally."
"Sharni..."
Geralt cleared his throat.
"Sharni told me about the snoops following you. You lost them, I understand."
"You don't understand anything."
"Ryonce?"
"Worse."
"In that case, I really don't understand."
"Wait.
The Redanians.
Traitagor.
Dykstra?"
"You've guessed."
"That's still no reason."
"It's reason enough," interrupted Dandelion. "They're not concerned about Ryonce anymore, Geralt. They're after the girl and Yennefer. Dykstra wants to know where they are. He's going to force you to disclose it to him. Do you understand now?"
"I do now, and so we're fleeing. Does it have to be through the window?"
"Absolutely. Sharni, will you manage?" The student of medicine smoothed down her robe. "It won't be my first window."
"I was sure of that."
The poet scrutinized her intently, counting on seeing a blush worthy of rhyme and metaphor. He miscalculated. Mirth in her hazel eyes and an impudent smile were all he saw. A big grey owl glided down to the sill without a sound. Sharni cried out quietly. Geralt reached for his sword.
"Don't be silly, Philippa," said Dandelion.
The owl disappeared, and Philippa Eilhart appeared in its place, squatting awkwardly. The magician immediately jumped into the room, smoothing down her hair and clothes.
"Good evening," she said coldly. "Introduce me, Dandelion.
Geralt of Rivia, Sharni of Medicine, and that owl, which so craftily flew in my tracks, is no owl. This is Philippa Eilhart from the Council of Wizards, at present in King Vizimir's service and pride of the Tretagor Court. It's a shame we've only got one chair in here."
"It's quite enough."
The enchantress made herself comfortable in the high-backed chair vacated by Dandelion, and cast a smouldering glance over those present, fixing her eyes somewhat longer on Sharni. The medical student, to Dandelion's surprise, suddenly blushed.
"In principle, what I've come about is the sole concern of Geralt of Rivia," Philippa began after a short pause. "I'm aware, however, that to ask anybody to leave would be tactless, and so..." "I can leave," said Sharni hesitantly.
"You can't," muttered Geralt. "No one can until the situation's made clear. Isn't that so, my lady?"
"Philippa, to you," smiled the enchantress. "Let's throw formalities aside, and no one has to go. No one's presence bothers me. Astonishes me, at most. But what to do? Life is an endless train of surprises. As one of my friends says... as our mutual friend says, Geralt. You're studying medicine, are you, Sharni? What year?"
"Third,"
grunted the girl.
"Ah."
Philip Eilhart was looking not at her, but at the Witcher.
17. What a beautiful age. Yennefer would give a lot to be that age again. What do you reckon, Geralt? Because I'll ask her when I get the chance."
The Witcher smiled nastily.
"I've no doubt you will ask. I've no doubt you'll follow the question with a commentary. I've no doubt it'll amuse you no end. Now come to the point, please."
"Quite right."
The magician nodded, growing serious.
"It's high time, and you haven't got much time. Dandelion has, no doubt, already informed you that Dykstra has suddenly acquired the wish to see and talk to you to establish the location of a certain girl. Dykstra has orders from King Vizimir on this matter, and so I think he will be very insistent that you reveal this place to him."
"Of course. Thank you for the warning. Only one thing puzzles me a little. You say Dykstra received instructions from the king, and you didn't receive any? After all, you hold a prominent seat in Vizimir's council."
"Indeed."
The magician was not perturbed by the jibe.
"I do. I take my responsibilities seriously, and they consist of warning the king against making mistakes. Sometimes, as in this particular instance, I am not allowed to tell the king outright that he is committing a mistake, or to dissuade him from a hasty action. I simply have to render it impossible for him to make a mistake. You understand what I'm saying."
The Witcher confirmed with a nod. Dandelion wondered whether he really did understand, because he knew that Philippa was lying through her teeth.
"So, I see," said Geralt slowly, proving that he understood perfectly well, "that the Council of Wizards is also interested in my ward. The wizards wish to find out where my ward is, and they want to get to her before Visimir or anybody else does. Why, Philippa? What is it about my ward? What makes her so very interesting?"
The magician's eyes narrowed.
"Don't you know?" she hissed. "Do you know so little about her? I wouldn't like to draw any hasty conclusions, but such a lack of knowledge would indicate that your qualifications as her guardian amount to nothing. In truth, I'm surprised that being so unaware and so lacking in information, you decided to look after her. And not only that, you decided to deny the right to look after her to others. Others who have both the qualifications and the right. And on top of that, you ask why. Careful, Geralt, or your arrogance will be the end of you. Watch out, and guard that child, dammit. Guard that girl as though she's the apple of your eye. And if you can't do so yourself, ask others to."
For a moment, Dandelion thought the Witcher was going to mention the role undertaken by Yennefer. He would not be risking anything, and would flatten Philippa's arguments. But Geralt said nothing. The poet guessed why. Philippa knew everything. Philippa was warning him, and the Witcher understood her warning. He concentrated on observing their eyes and faces, wondering whether by any chance something in the past had tied the two together. Dandelion knew that similar duels of words and allusions, demonstrating a mutual fascination, waged between the Witcher and Enchantresses, very often ended in bed. But observation, as usual, gave him nothing. There was only one way to find out whether something had tied the Witcher to anyone. One had to enter through the window at the appropriate moment.
"To look after someone," the Enchantress continued after a while, "means to take upon oneself the responsibility for the safety of a person unable to assure that safety for herself. If you expose your ward, if she comes to any misfortune, the responsibility falls on you, Geralt. Only you."
"I know."
"I'm afraid you still know too little."
"So, enlighten me. What makes so many people suddenly want to free me from the burden of that responsibility? Want to take on my duties and care for my ward? What does the Council of Wizards want from Ciri? What do Dykstra and King Visimir want from her? What do the Temerians want from her? What does a certain Ryonce, who has already murdered 3 people in Sodden and Temeria who were in touch with me and the girl 2 years ago, want from her? Who almost murdered Dandelion trying to extract information about her? Who is this Ryonce, Philippa?"
"I don't know," said the magician. "I don't know who Ryonce is, but, like you, I'd very much like to find out."
"Does this Ryonce," Sharni said unexpectedly, "have a 3rd-degree burn on his face? If so, then I know who he is, and I know where he is."
In the silence which fell, the first drops of rain knocked on the gutter outside the window. Murder is always murder, regardless of motive or circumstance. Thus, those who murder or who prepare to murder are malefactors and criminals, regardless of who they may be. Kings, princes, marshals, or judges. None who contemplates and commits violence has the right to consider himself better than an ordinary criminal, because it is in the nature of all violence to lead inevitably to crime. Nicodemus de Voot, Meditations on Life, Happiness and Prosperity. Chapter 6.
"Let us not commit a mistake," said Visimir, King of Redania, sliding his ringed fingers through the hair at his temples. "We can't afford to make a blunder or mistake now."
Those assembled said nothing. Demavend, ruler of Adian, sprawled in his armchair, staring at the tankard of beer resting on his belly. Foltest, the lord of Temeria, Pontar, Mahakam, and Sodden, and recently senior protector of Brugge, presented his noble profile to everyone by turning his head towards the window. At the opposite side of the table sat Henselt, king of Caedwen, running his small, piercing eyes, glistening from a face as bearded as a brigand's, over the other participants of the council. Meave, Queen of Lyria, toyed pensively with the enormous rubies in her necklace, occasionally twisting her beautiful full lips into an ambiguous grimace.
"Let us not commit a mistake," repeated Vizimir, "because a mistake could cost us too much. Let us make use of the experience of others. When our ancestors landed on the beaches 500 years ago, the elves also hid their heads in the sand. We tore the country away from them piece by piece, and they retreated, thinking all the while that this would be the last border, that we would encroach no further. Let us be wiser, because now it is our turn. Now we are the elves. Nilfgaard is at the Yeruga, and I hear, so let them stay there. I hear they won't come any further. But they will, you'll see. So, I repeat, let us not make the same mistake as the elves."
Raindrops knocked against the window panes, and the wind howled eerily. Queen Meave raised her head. She thought she heard the croaking of ravens and crows, but it was only the wind and rain.
"Do not compare us to the elves," said Henselt of Caedwin. "You dishonour us with such comparison. The elves did not know how to fight. They retreated before our ancestors and hid in the mountains and forests. The elves did not treat our ancestors to a sodden. But we showed the Nilfgaardians what it means to pick a quarrel with us. Do not threaten us with Nilfgaard, Vizimir. Don't sow the seeds of propaganda. Nilfgaard, you say, is at the Yeruga. I say that Nilfgaard is sitting as quiet as a church mouse beyond the river. Because we broke their spine at Sodden, we broke them militarily, and above all, we broke their morale. I don't know whether it's true that Emir Var Imris was, at the time, against aggression on such a scale that the attack on Sintra was the work of some party hostile to him. I take it that if they had defeated us, he would be applauding and distributing privileges and endowments amongst them. But after Sodden, it suddenly turns out he was against it, and that everything which occurred was due to his marshal's insubordination. And heads fell. The scaffolds flowed with blood. These are certain facts, not rumours. 8 solemn executions, and many more modest ones. Several apparently natural yet mysterious deaths. A good many cases of people suddenly choosing to retire. I tell you, Emir fell into a rage and practically finished off his own commanders. So, who will lead their army now? The sergeants?
No, not the sergeants, said Demavend of Adian coldly. It will be young and gifted officers who have long waited for such an opportunity and have been trained by Emir for an equally long time. Those whom the older marshals stopped from taking command, prevented from being promoted. The young, gifted commanders about whom we already hear. Those who crushed the uprisings in Metina and Nazaire, who rapidly broke up the rebels in Ebbing. Commanders who appreciate the roles of outflanking manoeuvres, of far-reaching cavalry raids, of swift infantry marches, and of landing operations from the sea. They use the tactics of crushing assaults in specific directions. They use the newest siege techniques instead of relying on the uncertainties of magic. They must not be underestimated. They are itching to cross the Yeruga and prove that they have learned from the mistakes of their old marshals.
If they have truly learned anything, Henselt shrugged, they will not cross the Yeruga. The river estuary on the border between Sintra and Verden is still controlled by Erville and his 3 strongholds, Nastrog, Rosrog, and Bodrog. They cannot be seized just like that. No new technology is going to help them there. Our flank is defended by Ithane of Sidaris's fleet, and thanks to it we control the shore, and also thanks to the pirates of Skellige. Jarl Krach and Kreet, if you remember, didn't sign a truce with Nilfgaard, and regularly bites them, attacking and setting fire to their maritime settlements and forts in the provinces. The Nilfgaardians have nicknamed him Terth Ismur, Seabor. They frighten children with him.
Frightening Nilfgaardian children, smiled Vizimir wryly, will not ensure our safety.
No, agreed Henselt. Something else will. Without control of the estuary or the shore, and with a flank exposed, Emir Var Imris will be in no position to ensure provisions reach any detachments he might care to send across the Yeruga. What swift marches! What cavalry raids! Ridiculous! The army will come to a standstill within 3 days of crossing the river. Half will lay siege to the stronghold, and the rest will be slowly dispersed to plunder the region in search of fodder and food. And when their famed cavalry has eaten most of its own horses, we'll give them another sodden. Damn it, I'd like them to cross the river, but don't worry, they won't.
Let us say, Meave of Lyria said suddenly, that they do not cross the Aruga. Let us say that Nilfgaard will simply wait. Now let us consider, who would that suit, them or us? Who can let themselves wait and do nothing, and who can't?
Exactly, picked up Visimir. Meave, as usual, does not say much, but she hits the nail on the head. Emir has time on his hands, gentlemen, but we don't. Can't you see what is happening? 3 years ago, Nilfgaard disturbed a small stone on the mountainside, and now they are calmly waiting for an avalanche. They can simply wait while new stones keep pouring down the slope, because to some, that first small stone looked like a boulder which would be impossible to move. And since it turned out that a mere touch sufficed to set it rolling, others appeared for whom an avalanche would prove convenient. From the Grey Mountains to Bremervord, elven commandos rove the forests. This is no longer a small group of guerrilla fighters. This is war. Just wait, and we'll see the free elves of Dol Blathanna rising to fight. In Mahakam, the dwarves are rebelling. The dryads of Brokilon are growing bolder and bolder. This is war. War on a grand scale. Civil war. Domestic. Our own. While Nilfgaard waits. Whose side do you think time is on? The Scoia'tael commandos have 30 or 40-year-old elves fighting for them, and they live for 300 years. They have time, we don't.
The Scoia'tael, admitted Henseld, have become a real thorn in the backside. They're paralyzing my trade and transport, terrorizing the farmers. We have to put an end to this.
If the non-humans want war, they will get it, threw in Foltest of Temeria. I have always been an advocate of mutual agreement and coexistence, but if they prefer a test of strength, then we will see who is the stronger. I am ready. I undertake to put an end to the squirrels in Temeria and Sodden within 6 months. Those lands have already run with elven blood once, shed by our ancestors. I consider the bloodletting a tragedy, but I do not see an alternative. The tragedy will be repeated. The elves have to be pacified.
Your army will march against the elves if you give the order, nodded Demavend. But will it march against humans? Against the peasantry from which you muster your infantry? Against the guilds? Against the free towns? Speaking of the Scoia'tael, Vishimir described only one stone in the avalanche. Yes, yes, gentlemen, do not gape at me like that. Word is already going round the villages and towns that on the lands already taken by the Nilfgaard, peasants, farmers and craftsmen are having an easier life, freer and richer, and that merchants' guilds have more privileges. We are inundated with goods from Nilfgaardian manufactories. In Brugge and Verden, their coin is ousting local currency. If we sit and do nothing, we will be finished, at odds with our neighbours, embroiled in conflict, tangled up in trying to quell rebellions and riots, and slowly subdued by the economic strength of the Nilfgaardians. We will be finished, suffocating in our own stuffy parochial corner, because, understand this, Nilfgaard is cutting off our route to the south, and we have to develop. We have to be expansive, otherwise there won't be enough room here for our grandchildren.
Those gathered said nothing. Visimir of Redania sighed deeply, grabbed one of the chalices standing on the table, and took a long draught. Rain battered against the windows throughout the prolonged silence, and the wind howled and pounded against the shutters.
All the worries of which we talk, said Henselt finally, is the work of Nilfgaard. It is Emir's emissaries who are inciting the non-humans, spreading propaganda and calling for riots. It is they who are throwing gold around and promising privileges to corporations and guilds, assuring barons and dukes they will receive high positions in the provinces they plan to create in place of our kingdoms. I don't know what it's like in your countries, but in Caedwin we've been inundated with clerics, preachers, fortune-tellers, and other shitty mystics, all appearing out of the blue, all preaching the end of the world.
It's the same in my country, agreed Foltest.
Damn it, for so many years there was peace.
Ever since my grandfather showed the clerics their place and decimated their ranks, those who remained stuck to useful tasks. They studied books and instilled knowledge in children, treated the sick, took care of the poor, the handicapped and the homeless. They didn't get mixed up in politics. And now, all of a sudden, they've woken up and are yelling nonsense to the rabble. And the rabble is listening and believes they know at last why their lives are so hard. I put up with it because I'm less impetuous than my grandfather and less sensitive about my royal authority and dignity than he was. What sort of dignity or authority would it be anyway if it could be undermined by the squealings of some deranged fanatic? But my patience is coming to an end. Recently, the main topic of preaching has been of a saviour who will come from the south. From the south! From beyond the Yaruga!
The white flame, muttered Demavend.
White chill will come to be, and after it the white light, and then the world will be reborn through the white flame and the white queen.
I've heard it too.
It's a travesty of the prophecy of Aethlina Ap Ivanian, the elven seeress. I gave orders to catch one cleric who was going on about it in the Vengerberg marketplace, and the torturer asked him politely and at length how much gold the prophet had received from Emir for doing it. But the preacher only prattled on about the white flame and the white queen. The same thing to the very end.
Careful, Demavend, grimaced Vizimir. Don't make any martyrs. That's exactly what Emir is after. Catch all the Nilfgaardian agents you please, but do not lay hands on clerics. The consequences are too unpredictable. They still are held in regard and have an important influence on people. We have too much trouble with the squirrels to risk riots in our towns or war against our own peasants.
Damn it, snorted Foltest. Let's not do this, let's not risk that, we mustn't this, we mustn't that. Have we gathered here to talk about all we can't do? Is that why you dragged us all to Hagar, Demavend? To cry our hearts out and bemoan our weakness and helplessness? Let us finally do something. Something must be done. What is happening has to be stopped. I've been saying that from the start.
Vizimir pulled himself up.
I propose action. What sort of action? What can we do?
Silence fell again. The wind blustered. The shutters banged against the castle wall.
Why, said Meave suddenly, are you all looking at me?
We're admiring your beauty,
Henselt mumbled from the depths of his tankard.
That too, seconded Vizimir.
Meave, we all know you can find a solution to everything. You have a woman's intuition. You're a wise
Stop flattering me.
The Queen of Lyria clasped her hands in her lap and fixed her gaze on the darkened tapestries with their depictions of hunting scenes. Hounds, extended in a leap, were turning the muzzles up towards the flanks of a fleeing white unicorn.
I've never seen a live unicorn, thought Meave. Never, and I probably never will.
The situation in which we find ourselves, she said after a while, tearing her eyes away from the tapestry, reminds me of long winter evenings in Rivian Castle. Something always hung in the air. My husband would be contemplating how to get his hands on yet another maid of honour. The marshal would be working out how to start a war which would make him famous. The wizard would imagine he was king. The servants wouldn't feel like serving. The jester would be sad, gloomy, and excruciatingly dull. The dogs would howl with melancholy, and the cats sleep, careless of any mice that might be scuttling around on the table. Everybody was waiting for something. Everyone was scowling at me. And I? Then I showed them. I showed them all what I was capable of, in a way that made the very walls shake and the local grizzly bears wake in their winter lairs, and any silly thoughts disappeared from their heads in a trice. Suddenly, everyone knew who ruled. No one uttered a word. The wind howled a little louder. The guards on the buttresses outside hailed each other casually. The patter of drops on the panes in the lead window frames grew to a frenzied staccato.
Nilfgaard is watching and waiting, continued Meave slowly, toying with her necklace. Nilfgaard is observing us. Something is hanging in the air. Silly thoughts are springing up in many heads. So, let us show them what we are capable of. Let us show them who is really king here. Let us shake the walls of this great castle plunged into a winter torpor.
Eradicate the squirrels, said Henselt quickly. Start a huge joint military operation. Treat the non-humans to a bloodbath. Let the Pontar, Gwentlech, and Bwina flow with elven blood from source to estuary.
Send a penal expedition to smother the free elves of Dolblatana, added Demavend, frowning. March an interventionary force into Mahakam. Allow Urville of Verdane a chance, at last, to get at the Dryads in Brokilon.
Yes, a bloodbath, and any survivors, to the reservations.
Set Crack and Crate at the Nilfgaardian shores, picked up Vizimir. Support him with Ithane of Sidaris' fleet. Let them go ravaging from the Yaruga to Ebbing. A show of strength, not enough.
Foltest shook his head. All of that is still not enough. We need... I know what we need.
So tell us.
Sintra.
What?
To take Sintra back from the Nilfgaardians. Let us cross the Yaruga, be the first to attack. Now, while they don't expect it, let us throw them out, back beyond the Marnadal.
How? We've just said that it's impossible for an army to cross the Yaruga.
Impossible for Nilfgaard. But we have control of the river. We hold the estuary in our grasp, and the supply routes and our flank is protected by Skellige, Sidaris, and the strongholds in Verdane. For Nilfgaard, getting 40 or 50,000 men across the river is a considerable effort. We can get far more across to the left bank. Don't gape, Vizimir. You wanted something to put an end to the waiting. Something spectacular? Something which will make us true kings again? That something is Sintra. Sintra will bind us and our rule together, because Sintra is a symbol. Remember Sodden. If it were not for the massacre of that town and Calanthe's martyrdom, there would not have been such a victory then. The forces were equal. No one counted on our crushing them like that. But our armies threw themselves at their throats like wolves, like rabid dogs, to avenge the lioness of Sintra. And there are those whose fury was not quelled by the blood spilt on the field of Sodden. Remember Crachan Crate, the wild boar of the sea.
That is true, nodded Demavend. Crack swore bloody vengeance on Nilfgaard, for East Tirsic killed at Marnadal, and for Calanthe. If we were to strike at the left bank, Crack would back us up with all the strength of Skellige.
By the gods, this has a chance at success.
I back Foltest. Let us not wait. Let us strike first. Let us liberate Sintra and chase those sons of bitches beyond the Amel Pass.
Slow down, snarled Henselt. Don't be in such a hurry to tug the lion's whiskers, because this lion is not dead yet. This is for starters. Secondly, if we are the first to strike, we will put ourselves in the position of aggressors. We will be breaking the truce to which we all put our seals. We will not be backed by Nirdemir and his league. We will not be backed by Esterad Thyssen. I don't know how Ithane of Sidaris will react. An aggressive war will also be opposed by our guilds, merchants, nobles, and above all, the wizards. Do not forget the wizards.
The wizards won't back an assault on the left bank, confirmed Vizimir. The peace agreement was the work of Vilgefortz of Roggeveen. It is well known that his plan was for the armistice to gradually turn into permanent peace. Vilgefortz will not back a war. And the chapter, believe me, will do whatever Vilgefortz wishes. After Sodden, he has become the most important person in the chapter. Let other magicians say what they will. Vilgefortz plays first fiddle there.
Vilgefortz, Vilgefortz, bridled Foltest. He has grown too large for us, that magician. Taking into account Vilgefortz's and the chapter's plans which I am not acquainted with anyway, and which I do not understand at that, is beginning to annoy me. But there is a way around that too, gentlemen. What if it were Nilfgaard who was the aggressor? At Dol Angra, for example, against Adian and Lyria. We could arrange that somehow, could stage some tiny provocation, a border incident caused by them, an attack on a border fort, let us say. We will, of course, be prepared. We will react decisively and forcefully with everybody's full acceptance, including that of Vilgefortz and the entire chapter of wizards. And when Emhyrvar Emrys turns his back from Sodden and Transriver, the Sintrians will demand their country back. All the emigrants and refugees who are gathering themselves in Brugge under Visigerd's leadership. Nearly 8,000 of them are armed. Could there be a better spearhead? They live in the hope of regaining the country they were forced to flee. They are burning to fight. They are ready to strike the left bank. They await only the battle cry. The battle cry, bore out Meave, and the promise that we will back them up. Because Emir can command 8,000 men at his border garrison. With that strength,
he won't even have to send for relief troops. Visigerd knows this very well, and won't move until he has the assurance that your armies, Foltest, reinforced by Redanian corps, will disembark on the left bank at his heels. But above all, Visigerd is waiting for the lion cub of Sintra. Apparently, the queen's granddaughter survived the slaughter. Allegedly, she was seen amongst the refugees, but the child mysteriously disappeared. The emigrants persist in their search for her, because they need someone of royal blood to sit on their regained throne. Someone of Calanthe's blood.
Nonsense, said Foltis coldly. More than 2 years have passed. If the child has not been found by now, she's dead. We can forget that myth. Calanthe is no more, and there is no lion cub, no royal blood to whom the throne belongs. Sintra will never again be what it was during the lioness's lifetime. Obviously, we cannot say that to Visigerd's emigrants.
So, you're going to send Sintran guerrillas to their deaths? Meave narrowed her eyes. In the line of attack? Not telling them that Sintra can only be reborn as a vassal country under your protectorship? You are proposing to all of us an attack on Sintra for your own gain? You have suborned Sodden and Brugger for yourself, are sharpening your teeth on Verden, and now you have caught a whiff of Sintra. Is that right?
Admit it, Foltest, snapped Henselt. Is Meave right? Is that why you are inciting us to this affair?
Come on, leave it. The ruler of Temeria furrowed his noble brow and bristled angrily.
Don't make me out as some conqueror dreaming of an empire. What are you talking about? Sodden and Brugger? Ekkehard of Sodden was my mother's half-brother. Are you surprised that following his death the Free States brought the crown to me, his relative? Blood, not water. And yes, Venslav of Brugger paid me homage as a vassal, but without coercion. He did it to protect his country, because on a fine day he can see Nilfgaardian lances flashing on the left bank of the Yeruga.
And we are talking about the left bank, drawled out the Queen of Lyria. The bank we are to strike. And the left bank is Sintra. Destroyed, burned out, ruined, decimated and occupied. But still Sintra. The Sintrians won't bring you their crown, Foltest, nor will they pay you homage. Sintra will not agree to be a vassal state. Blood, not water.
Sintra, when we liberate it, should it become our joint protectorate, said Demavend of Adian. Sintra is at the mouth of the Yeruga, in too important a strategic position to allow ourselves to lose control over it.
It has to be a free country, objected Visimir. Free, independent and strong. A country which will be an iron gateway, a bulwark to the north, and not a strip of burned ground over which the Nilfgaardian cavalry will be able to gather speed.
Is it possible to rebuild such a Sintra, without Calanthe?
Don't get all worked up, Foltest, pouted Meave. I've already told you. The Sintrians will never accept a protectorate or foreign blood on their throne. If you try to force yourself on them as their lord, the tables will be turned. Visigerd will again prepare his troops for battle, but this time under Emir's wings. And one day, those detachments are going to assail us in the vanguard of a Nilfgaardian onslaught, as the spear point as you just vividly described it.
Foltest knows that, snorted Visimir. That's why he's searching so hard for this lion cub, for Calanthe's granddaughter. Don't you understand? Blood, not water. The crown through marriage. It's enough for him to find the girl and force her to marry. Are you out of your mind? Choked out the king of Temeria. The lion cub is dead. I'm not looking for the girl at all. But if I were, it has not even occurred to me to force her to do such a thing.
You wouldn't have to force her, interrupted Meave, smiling charmingly. You are still a strapping, handsome man, cousin. And Calanthe's blood runs through the lion cub. Very hot blood. I knew Callie when she was young. When she saw a fellow she liked, she leapt up and down so fast that if you put dry twigs beneath her feet, they would have caught real fire. Her daughter, Pavetta, the lion cub's mother, was exactly the same. So, no doubt, the lion cub has not fallen far from the apple tree. A bit of effort, Foltest, and the girl would not be long in resisting. That is what you are counting on. Admit it.
Of course he's counting on it, chuckled Demavend. Our king has thought of a cunning little plan for himself. We assail the left bank, and before we realize it, our Foltest will have found the girl, won her heart, and have a young wife whom he will place on the throne of Sintra while her people cry for joy and pee in their knickers for happiness. For they will have their queen, blood of the blood, and flesh of the flesh of Calanthe. They will have a queen, albeit one who comes with a king. King Foltest.
What rubbish!
Yelled Foltest, turning red, then white in turn.
What's got into you? There's not a grain of sense in your prattling.
There is a whole lot of sense, said Visimir dryly. Because I know that someone is searching for the child very earnestly.
Who, Foltest? Well, it's obvious. Visigerd and the Cintrians.
No, it's not them. At least not just them. Someone else is, too. Someone who is leaving a trail of corpses behind them. Someone who does not shrink from blackmail, bribery, or torture. While we are on the subject, is a gentleman by the name of Ryons in any of your services? Ah, I see from your expressions that either he isn't or you won't admit it, which comes to the same thing. I repeat, they are searching for Calanthe's granddaughter, and searching in such a way as to make you think twice about their intentions. Who is looking for her? I ask.
Hell!
Foltest thumped his fist on the table.
It's not me. It never occurred to me to marry some child for some throne. After all,
After all, you have been secretly sleeping with the Baroness Lavalette for the past 4 years. Meave smiled again. You love each other like two turtle doves, and just wait for the old Baron to finally kick the bucket.
What are you staring at? We all know about it. What do you think we pay our spies for?
But for the throne of Sintra, cousin, many a king would be prepared to sacrifice his personal happiness.
Hold on.
Henselt scratched his beard with a rasp.
Many a king, you say? Then leave Foltest in peace for a moment. There are others. In her time, Calanthe wanted to give her granddaughter's hand to Erville of Verden's son. Erville, too, might have caught a whiff of Sintra, and not just him.
Muttered Visimir. True.
Erville has 3 sons. And what about those present here who also have male descendants? Huh? Me? Are you not, by any chance, pulling wool over our eyes?
You can count me out. The Queen of Lyria smiled even more charmingly.
It is true. 2 of my offspring are roaming the world, the fruits of delightful abandon, if they have not been brought to the gallows yet. I doubt that either of them would suddenly desire to be king. They were neither predisposed nor inclined that way. Both were even stupider than their father. May he rest in peace. Whoever knew my deceased husband will understand what I mean.
That's a fact, agreed the King of Redania. I knew him.
Are your sons really more stupid?
Damn it. I thought it wasn't possible to get any more stupid. Forgive me, Meave.
It's nothing, Visimir.
Who else has sons?
You do, Henselt.
My son is married.
And what is poison for? For the throne of Sintra, as someone here so wisely said, many would sacrifice their personal happiness. It would be worth it.
I will not permit such insinuations, and leave me alone. Others have sons, too.
Neardamir of Hengfors has 2, and is a widower himself, and he isn't old.
And don't forget Esterad Thyssen of Covier.
I would count those out.
Visimir shook his head. The Hengfors League and Covier are planning a dynastic union with each other. They are not interested in Sintra or the South.
But Erville of Verden? It's not so far from him. There is someone else who is just as near, remarked Demavend suddenly. Who? Emir Var Emrys. He is not married, and he is younger than you, Foltest. Bloody hell!
The King of Redania frowned.
If that were true, Emir would bugger us without grease. It's obvious that the people and nobility of Sintra will follow Calanthe's blood. Imagine what would happen if Emir were to get his hands on the lion cub. Damn it, that's all we need. Queen of Sintra and Empress of Nilfgaard?
Empress, snorted Henselt. You exaggerate, Visimir. What does Emir need the girl for? What the hell does he need to get married for? The throne of Sintra? Emir already has Sintra. He conquered the country and made it a province of Nilfgaard. He's got his whole butt on the throne and still has enough room to wriggle about.
Firstly, noted Foltest, Emir grips Sintra by law, or rather by an aggressor's lawlessness. If he had the girl and married her, he could rule legally. You understand? Nilfgaard, bound in marriage to Calanthe's blood, is no longer Nilfgaard the invader, at which the entire north bears its teeth. It is Nilfgaard the neighbour, whom one has to take into account. How would you want to force such a Nilfgaard beyond Marnadal, beyond the Amel passes?
attacking a kingdom whose throne is legally occupied by the lion cub granddaughter of the lioness of Sintra. Pox! I don't know who's looking for that child. I'm not looking for her. But I declare that now I'm going to start to. I still believe the girl is dead. But we can't take the risk. It looks as if she is too important. If she survived, then we must find her.
And shall we decide now who she will marry when we find her?
Henselt grimaced.
Such matters should not be left to chance. We could, for that matter, hand her over to Visigerd's guerrillas as a battle standard tied to a long pole. They could carry her before the front line as they attacked the left bank. But if the recaptured Sintra is to be useful to us, surely you see what I mean. If we attack Nilfgaard and retrieve Sintra, the lion cub can be put on the throne. But the lion cub can have only one husband. One who will look after our interests at the mouth of the Yeruga. Who of those present is going to volunteer?
Not me, joked Meave. I waive the privilege.
I wouldn't exclude those who aren't present here, said Demavend seriously. Neither Ervil nor Niedemir, nor the Thysons. And bear in mind that Visigerd could surprise you and put the standard attached to a long pole to unexpected use. You've heard about morganatic marriages. Visigerd is old and as ugly as cow's dung, but with enough decoctions of absinthe and Damiana down her throat, the lion cub might unexpectedly fall in love with him. Is King Visigerd included in our plans?
No, muttered Foltest. Not in mine.
Visimir hesitated. Nor in mine. Visigerd is a tool, not a partner. That's the role he is to play in our plans for attacking Nilfgaard, that and no other. Besides, if the one who is so earnestly seeking the lion cub is indeed Emhyr Var Emrys, we cannot take the risk.
Absolutely not, seconded Foltest. The lion cub cannot fall into Emhyr's hands. She cannot fall into anybody's. Into the wrong hands. Alive.
Infanticide? Meave grimaced. An ugly solution, my kings. Unworthy, and surely unnecessarily drastic. First of all, let us find the girl, because we still don't have her. And when we have found her, give her to me. I'll keep her in some castle in the mountains for a couple of years, and marry her off to one of my knights. When you see her again, she will already have two children and a belly out here.
Leading two, if I count correctly, at least three future eventual pretenders and usurpers?
Visimir nodded.
No, Meave. It is ugly indeed. But the lion cub, if she has survived, must now die. For reasons of state.
Gentlemen? The rain hammered against the windows. The gale howled among the towers of Haga Castle. The kings grew silent.
Visimir, Foltest, Demavend, Henselt and Meave, repeated the Marshal. They met in a secret council in Haga Castle, on the Pontar. They conferred in privacy.
How symbolic, said the slender black-haired man, wearing an elk tunic marked with the imprints of armour and rust stains, without looking round. After all, it was at Haga not 40 years ago that Virfioril defeated Medel's armies, strengthened his control over the Pontar Valley, and established today's borders between Aedirn and Temeria. And today, Demavend, Virfioril's son, invites Foltest, Medel's son, to Haga, summoning Visimir of Tretagor, Henselt of Ard Carach, and the merry widow Meave of Lyria to complete the set. They are meeting now and holding council in secrecy. Can you guess what they are discussing, Coehorn?
I can,
the Marshal replied succinctly. He did not say a word more. He knew that the man with his back turned hated anyone to display any eloquence or comment on obvious facts in his presence. They did not invite Ithain of Sidaris. The man in the elk tunic turned away from the window, clasped his hands behind his back, and strolled slowly from the window to the table, and then back again. Nor Ervil of Verden. They did not invite Estrad Thysen of Niedemir, which means they are either very sure of themselves, or very unsure. They did not invite anyone from the Chapter of Wizards, which is interesting and significant. Coehorn, try to see to it that the wizards learn of this council. Let them know that their monarchs do not treat them as equals. It seems to me that the wizards of the Chapter have had some doubts in this respect. Disperse them.
it's an order.
Any news from Rayons?
None.
The man paused at the window and stood there for a long while, gazing at the hills drenched in rain. Kohihorn waited restlessly, clenching and unclenching his fist around the pommel of his sword. He was afraid he would be forced to listen to a long monologue. The marshal knew that the man standing at the window considered his monologues a conversation, and viewed conversation as a privilege and proof of trust. He knew this, but still didn't like listening to the monologues.
"How do you find the country, Governor? Have you grown to like your new province?"
He shuddered, taken unawares. He did not expect the question, but he did not ponder the answer for long. Insincerity and indecisiveness could cost him a great deal.
"No, Your Highness, I haven't. That country is so gloomy."
"It was different once," the man replied without looking round.
"And it will be different again. You will see. You will still see a beautiful, happy Sintra, Kohihorn. I promise you. But don't be saddened. I shan't keep you here long. Someone else will take over the governorship of the province. I'll be needing you in Dolangra. You'll leave immediately once the rebellion is quashed. I need someone responsible in Dolangra. Someone who will not allow himself to be provoked. The merry widow of Lyria or Demavend will want to provoke us. You'll take the young officers in hand, cool their hot heads. You will let yourselves be provoked only when I give the order. No sooner."
"Yes, sir."
The clatter of arms and spurs and the sound of raised voices came from the antechamber. Someone knocked on the door. The man in the elk tunic turned away from the window and nodded his head in consent. The marshal bowed a little and left. The man returned to the table, sat down, and lowered his head over some maps. He studied them for a long time, then finally rested his brow on his interlocked hands. The enormous diamond in his ring sparkled in the candlelight as if a thousand flames.
"Your Highness?"
The door squeaked faintly. The man did not change his position, but the marshal noticed that his hands twitched. He spotted it by the flash of the diamond. He closed the door carefully and quietly behind him.
"News, Kohihorn? From Rayons, maybe?"
"No, Your Highness, but good news. The rebellion in the province has been quelled. We have broken up the rebels. Only a few managed to escape to Verden, and we've caught their leader, Duke Windhelm of Atre."
"Good," said the man after a while, still not raising his head from his hands. "Windhelm of Atre. Order him to be beheaded. No, not beheaded. Executed in some other way. Spectacularly, lengthily, and cruelly. And publicly, it goes without saying. A terrifying example is necessary, something that will frighten others. Only please, Kohihorn, spare me the details. You don't have to bother with a vivid description in your report. I take no pleasure from it."
The marshal nodded, then swallowed hard. He too found no pleasure in it. No pleasure whatsoever. He intended to leave the preparation and performance of the execution to the specialists, and he did not have the least intention of asking those specialists for details. And above all, he did not intend to be there.
"You will be present at the execution."
The man raised his head, picked a letter up from the table, and broke the seal.
"Officially, as the governor of the province of Sintra. You will stand in for me. I don't intend to watch it. That's an order, Kohihorn."
"Yes, sir."
The marshal did not even try to hide his embarrassment and discomfort. The man who had given the order did not allow anything to be kept from him, and rarely did anyone succeed in doing so. The man glanced at the open letter and almost immediately threw it into the fire, into the hearth.
"Kohihorn?"
"Yes, Your Highness."
"I am not going to wait for Rayons' report. Set the magicians to work and have them prepare a telecommunication link with their point of contact in Redania. Let them pass on my verbal orders, which must immediately be sent to Rayons. The order is to run as follows. Rayons is to stop pussyfooting around and to stop playing with the Witcher, else it could end badly. No one toys with the Witcher. I know him, Kohihorn. He is too clever to lead Rayons to the trail. I repeat, Rayons is to organize the assassination immediately, to take the Witcher out of the game at once. He's to kill him and then disappear.
Bide his time and await my orders. If he comes across the Enchantress's trail before that, he is to leave her alone. Not a hair on Yennefer's head is to be harmed. Have you remembered that, Coehorn?
Yes, sir.
The communique is to be coded and firmly secured against any magical deciphering. Forewarn the wizards about this. If they bungle it, if any undesirables learn of my order, I will hold them responsible.
Yes, sir.
The marshal hawked and pulled himself up straight. What else, Coehorn?
The Count. He is here already, Your Highness. He came at your command.
Already? He smiled. Such speed is worthy of admiration. I hope he didn't exhaust that black horse of his everyone envies so much. Have him come in.
Am I to be present during the conversation, Your Highness?
Of course, Governor of Sintra. Summoned from the antechambers, the knight entered the chamber with an energetic, strong and noisy stride, his black armour grating. He stopped short, drew himself up proudly, threw his wet, muddy black cloak back from his shoulder, and laid his hand on the hilt of his mighty sword. He leaned his black helmet, adorned with wings of a bird of prey, on his hip. Coehorn looked at the knight's face. He saw there the hard pride of a warrior and impudence. He did not see any of the things that should have been visible in the face of one who had spent the past 2 years incarcerated in a place from which, as everything had indicated, he would only leave for the scaffold. A faint smile touched the marshal's lips. He knew that the disdain for death and crazy courage of youngsters stemmed from a lack of imagination. He knew that perfectly well. He had once been such a youngster himself. The man sitting at the table rested his chin on his interlaced fingers and looked at the knight intently. The youngster pulled himself up, taut as a string. In order for everything to be perfectly clear, the man behind the table addressed him. You should understand that the mistake you made in this town 2 years ago has not been forgiven. You are getting one more chance. You are getting one more order. My decision as to your ultimate fate depends on the way in which you carry it out. The young knight's face did not twitch, and nor did a single feather on the wings adorning the helmet at his hip. I never deceive anyone. I never give anyone false illusions, continued the man. So let it be known that, naturally, the prospect of saving your neck from the executioner's axe exists only if you do not make a mistake this time. Your chances of a full pardon are small. Your chances of my forgiving and forgetting are non-existent. The young knight in the black armour did not flinch this time either, but Coehorn detected the flash in his eyes.
He doesn't believe him, he thought. He doesn't believe him, and is deluding himself. He is making a great mistake.
I command your full attention, continued the man behind the table. Yours too, Coehorn, because the orders I am about to give concern you too. They come in a moment, for I have to give some thought to their substance and delivery. Marshal Menno Coehorn, governor of the province of Sintra, and future commander-in-chief of the Dol Angra army, lifted his head and stood to attention, his hand on the pommel of his sword. The same attitude was assumed by the knight in black armour with the bird of prey winged helmet. They both waited, in silence, patiently, the way one should wait for orders, the substance and presentation of which were being pondered by the Emperor of Nilfgaard, Emhir var Emrys daithwen adhan in carn eop Morvorth, the white flame dancing on the grave mounds of enemies. Ciri woke. She was lying, or rather half-sitting, with her head resting high on several pillows. The compresses on her forehead had grown warm and only slightly damp. She threw them off, unable to bear their unpleasant weight and their stinging against her skin. She found it hard to breathe. Her throat was dry, and her nose almost completely blocked with clots of blood. But the elixirs and spells had worked. The pain, which had exploded within her skull and dimmed her sight a few hours ago, had disappeared, and given way to a dull throbbing and a sensation of pressure on her temples. Carefully, she touched her nose with the back of her hand. It was no longer bleeding.
"What a strange dream I had," she thought. "The first dream for many days. The first where I wasn't afraid.
The first which wasn't about me. I was an observer. I saw everything as if from above, from high up, as if I were a bird. A night bird. A dream in which I saw Geralt.
In the dream, it was night, and the rain which furrowed the surface of the canal, spattered on the shingle roofs and thatches of sheds, glistened on the planks of footbridges and the decks of boats and barges. And Geralt was there, not alone. There was a man with him in a funny hat with a feather, limp from the damp, and a slim girl in a green cloak with a hood. All three were walking slowly and carefully along a wet footbridge.
And I saw them from above, as if I were a bird. A night bird.
Geralt had stopped short.
"Is it still far?" he had asked.
"No," the slim girl had answered, shaking the water off her green cloak. "We're almost there."
"Hey, Dandelion, don't lag behind or you'll get lost in these cul-de-sacs. And where the hell is Philippa?"
"I saw her a moment ago. She was flying alongside the canal."
"What foul weather.
Let's go. Lead on, Charney. And between you and me, where do you know this charlatan from? What have you got to do with him?" "I sometimes sell him medicaments, looted from the college workshop." "What are you staring at me like that for? My stepfather can barely pay for my tuition. I sometimes need a little money. And the charlatan, having real medicaments, treats people..."
"Or at least he doesn't poison them. Well, let's get going."
"Strange dream," thought Ciri. "Sheema woke up. I'd like to have seen what was going to happen. I'd like to know what they were doing there, where they were going."
From the chamber next door came the sound of voices, the voices which had woken her. Mother Nenica was speaking quickly, clearly worked up, agitated and angry.
"You betrayed my trust," she was saying. "I shouldn't have allowed it. I might have guessed that your dislike of her would lead to disaster. I shouldn't have allowed you to, because after all, I know you. You're ruthless, you're cruel, and to make matters worse, it turns out you're also irresponsible and careless. You're torturing that child mercilessly, forcing her to try things which she can't possibly do. You've no heart. You really have no heart, Yennefer."
Ciri pricked up her ears, wanting to hear the Enchantress's reply, her cold, hard and melodious voice, wanting to hear how she reacted, how she sneered at the High Priestess, how she ridiculed her overprotectiveness. She wanted to hear her say what she usually said, that using magic is no joke, that it isn't an occupation for young ladies made of porcelain, for dolls blown from thin glass. But Yennefer answered quietly, so quietly that the girl could neither understand nor even make out the individual words.
"I'll fall asleep," she thought,
carefully and delicately feeling her nose, which was still tender, painful, and blocked with clotted blood.
"I'll go back to my dream. I'll see what Geralt is doing there in the night, in the rain by the canal."
Yennefer was holding her by the hand. They were both walking down a long, dark corridor, between stone columns, or perhaps statues. Ciri could not make out their forms in the thick darkness. But there was someone there in that darkness, someone hiding and observing them as they walked. She heard whispers, quiet as the rustle of the wind. Yennefer was holding her by the hand, walking briskly and assuredly, full of decisiveness, so much so that Ciri could barely keep up with her. Doors opened before them in succession, one after another. An infinite number of doors, with gigantic, heavy leaves, opened up before them noiselessly. The darkness thickened. Ciri saw yet another great door in front of her. Yennefer did not slow her stride, but Ciri suddenly knew that this door would not open of its own accord. And she suddenly had an overwhelming certainty that this door must not be opened, that she must not go through it, that behind this door something was waiting for her. She stopped short, tried to pull away, but Yennefer's hand was strong and unyielding and unrelentingly dragged her forward. And Ciri finally understood that she had been betrayed, deceived, sold out, that ever since the first meeting, from the very beginning, from the first day, she had been no more than a marionette, a puppet on a string. She tugged harder, tore herself away from that grip. The darkness undulated like smoke, and the whispering in the dark all of a sudden died away. The magician took a step forward, stopped, turned round and looked at her.
"If you're afraid, turn back." "That door mustn't be opened. You know that."
"I do.
but you're still leading me there. If you're afraid, turn back. You still have time to turn back. It's not too late. And you? For me.